Intelligent design and DNA. Scholars can't explain it all away. Get ready to be awed by the handiwork of God. Tune in to Real Science Radio. Turn up the Real Science Radio. Keeping it real.
Welcome to the brightest audience in the country. I'm Fred Williams, host of Real Science Radio. I'm sure many in the audience have heard of genetic ancestry testing, and you've probably perhaps done your own DNA testing. Today, we're going to dive into the emerging field of historical genetics and see how it fits with a biblical timeline. But first, a reminder that tonight at 6 p.m. is the start of the ICR conference sponsored by the Denver Society of Creation. Dr. Randy Guiluza and Dr. Brian Thomas, both great friends of RSR, they'll be speaking tonight, and tomorrow they will be joined by Dr. Timothy Clary from ICR, and they're going to be presenting on topics such as dinosaurs and why the Earth looks so young. It's going to be a great conference. I'm going to be there. It's at Shepherd of the Hills Lutheran Church, which is 7601 South University Boulevard in Centennial, Colorado. For details, just go to denversocietyofcreation.org or youngearth.org, and you'll find all the information you need there. Also, in just 2 weeks is RMCF's youth conference that will have Carl Kirby as the speaker. Please spread the word at your church, to your youth leaders and parents, to get their youth out to this super critical event. Carl Kirby is a fantastic speaker, and I guarantee it will be well worth it. The website for sign-up is FFYC, which stands for Fearless Foundation Youth Conference, FFYCDenver.com. So back to today's show. We've spent a decent amount of time on Real Science Radio talking about the amazing complexity of our genome. I love talking about it, being a software engineer, how the DNA is a complex information system, and it can actually store just a mind-boggling amount of data. In fact, you could fit the entire content of the internet in just 1 gram of DNA. But there's another branch of genetics that is somewhat removed from the design aspect, and this is the emerging field of historical genetics, which through improving technology lets us look at DNA changes over time to build a family history of past generations. There's a new book coming out titled Traced: Humans' DNA Big Surprise, that goes beyond the DNA tests we just talked about and we take to find out about our ancestry. This research instead looks at the entire world's human history. One of the bullet points over at Amazon says that this new book represents one of the strongest arguments in print for the recent origin of humanity. Now, for me as a biblical creationist, that sounded awfully interesting, and I couldn't wait to get my hands on it. The book is written by Dr. Nathaniel Jeanson. He holds a PhD in cell and developmental biology from Harvard University, and he also happens to be a young Earth creationist. I was privileged to get a pre-release copy of this book just a few weeks ago. I have it in my hands, and I have the special honor of welcoming the author, Dr. Nathaniel Jeanson, to Real Science Radio. Nate, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me on, Fred.
Yeah, so, you know, there's not too many PhD Harvard grads who are young Earth creationists, at least that are open about it. You know, the other one I can think of is Dr. Kurt Wise. If I recall, he was a student of the late Stephen Jay Gould. I'm curious of your path to Harvard and your experience there.
In a nutshell, I guess you could say the grace of God, along with many other factors. I grew up in a Christian home, a strongly creationist home, I should say, born 1980 in Wisconsin. My parents were the sort of at the ground level of the homeschool movement at that time. So I grew up with going to worldview weekends, hearing Ken Ham, these sorts of speakers, creationist books in the house. And when they picked a Christian high school, so at that time, there was still some concern whether or not a homeschool high school diploma would be viewed as legitimate. So they sent me off to a Christian high school. There was only one in the area that would take a stand on Genesis. They sent me to that one. So I'd say I had a very strong, thanks to my parents, upbringing in this respect. And so when I went off to secular college, lived at home, but went off to University of Wisconsin Parkside, there was little that was surprising in the classroom or from the professors. Didn't feel like there was anything that was, oh, where did this come from? How to explain that? Because I had been well prepared for it. I also had a strong church home, a church background, people praying for me, supporting me. Also, people I could call on when I went off to Harvard and had questions. One of the main Bible science issues that came up there wasn't the creation evolution issue, but the ethical issues surrounding stem cells. I worked in a stem cell lab. I worked in adult stem cells, but my professor worked on embryonic stem cells as well. And there was a lot of debate at that time. So I started in 2003. There was a lot of debate 2003, 2009, dealing with embryonic stem cells, fetal to human tissue research, and so forth. So some of the people at my home church in Wisconsin were helpful in supporting me and navigating all that. Mm-hmm. And so all that together, I'd say prayers of people back there were a tremendous boon to being able to get through graduate school. I think one of the other factors as well that I probably don't appreciate fully was I went into molecular biology as an undergraduate. So that's basically just life at the smallest levels, rather than a traditional, let's say, zoology degree. I didn't try to be a zookeeper, where I think my coursework could probably have a lot more intense evolution. Same thing for graduate school. The research questions we're looking at were medically related, not origins related. So I have a special appreciation for those who've done hardcore origins degrees like geology, paleontology, where the subject matter day in and day out is age of the earth or evolution, these sorts of things. I feel like you have a whole extra set of challenges if you do that sort of thing. So that probably also played a role in making my task less hard than it could have been had I gone into something like evolutionary biology or something where the subject matter is a day in, day out challenge. And the professors may eventually tire of having someone who disagrees with them day in and day out.
Yeah. So, you know, I actually worked for a company that we built adult stem cell chambers to, you know, to harvest adult stem cells because of how effective they are. And it was interesting talking to some of the scientists that worked for, it was Cridian BCT. And, you know, I would bring up the whole thing about adult stem cells compared to embryonic and how, you know, much better adult stem cells are. And they really didn't have a problem with that. And they had no plans to use embryonic stem cells. But anyways, that's a side issue. You know, hopefully some of the youth who attend our conference in a few weeks will be inspired to do the same thing that you did, you know. It's just great. And I'm so appreciative that you went to a major university and you've got, you know, your advanced degree. And it's already paying huge dividends. I can tell that by having read through your book, which was fantastic. Now, your boss is Ken Ham, right?
That's correct.
At Answers in Genesis. And he said this, that you have found the Rosetta Stone of human history. So I want to get into this, some of the details of your book, because there's so many cool things in here. But I was wondering if we could start off, if you can give us a brief summary of your research in your book.
Yes, that's a great place. One of the key points, there's a couple of points that come to mind very quickly. One of the key fundamental elements of the what question, what are we doing? We're looking at primarily the male inherited DNA, the Y chromosome that goes from fathers to sons. Of course, we can get into a long debate about gender, which is cut and dry, black and white at the genetic level. You're either XY male or XX female. But we're looking at the male inherited DNA primarily. For some technical reasons we could go into, but would love to look at the female side as well. But there's a lot of statistical noise. That's the mitochondrial DNA. I had started work there and we got as far as we could, I think, in that respect. But there's a lot less statistical noise in the male inherited DNA. So we ran with that and we're looking at the echoes of human history. So the reason we're using DNA as a marker and as a tool to investigate our past is twofold. You think about trying to understand who we came from. Family trees would be the natural answer or the natural first choice to try to answer that question. And of course, written records can only take you back so far. My dad has done some digging into my own family tree, and I think we can go back to maybe the great, great, great grandparents, and that's it. Mm-hmm. So that gets you to maybe 1800s, not very far at all. How do you go further than that? Well, the Y chromosome is, first of all, inherited. It's a marker of inheritance, who you come from. You can look at my Y chromosome and test my dad's, test other people and say, okay, yeah, this is your dad. This is not your dad. So first of all, the Y chromosome marks inheritance. Secondly, when sperm cells in dad copy that Y chromosome, they make a copy of that DNA to pass on to the son. And then when sperm and egg meet, then you have a new male and point of life begins. When that Y chromosome is copied, there are mistakes that are made. On average, it's about 3 mistakes per generation. That's been measured. We live in a fallen world, so there's your theological reason for why these mistakes occur. Sin entered the world after Adam and Eve sinned, and so life isn't the perfect world that God created originally. This process of adding mistakes to the DNA acts like a clock. So if you compare my DNA to one of my son's, you will find about three differences between our Y chromosomes. If you compare my son's Y chromosome to my dad's, so that would be a grandson-grandfather comparison, mm-hmm. you've gone through two generations, there'd be about six differences. So these two elements, the fact that the Y chromosome can mark ancestry, who you come from, and it can mark time, the passage of generations, those are the true prerequisites for reconstructing a family tree. That's what family trees normally do. They tell you who you came from and then what generation you had a common ancestor with that person. So that's how this Y chromosome, this DNA tool, allows us then to interrogate human history. And that's the main focus then of the book. Can we figure out who we came from? And there's so much more that falls out of it. But that's the basic principle behind what the book is trying to do.
Okay. Yeah. So I want to bring out this point that you brought it to light in chapter four of your book. And that's really the weakness of the current DNA testing, because they don't look at just Y chromosome. They have a limited number of people, and you can only go back so far. So I think a lot of times when people do this testing, they take it as gospel. But from reading your book, I mean, there's a lot of noise in the statistics where, you know, I don't know, maybe Elizabeth Warren really is related to Pocahontas. From what I got from your book, the Y chromosome is the best way to look at it because of how it's passed down. And is it, correct me if I'm wrong, it's a pretty well, they call it conserved chromosome. It's not subject to a lot of differences in the population. It just has these mutations that occur that are pretty standard, the three a generation. Is that a correct understanding of the Y chromosome? It's actually fairly robust?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I appreciate you bringing that up. So one of the dirty little secrets to go back to your first point about the limitations of your standard genetic test, let's say you go to ancestry.com, they're typically going to test the DNA you get from both parents, not the Y chromosome. And I can say this because we've had a number of people write in having read the book or seen some of the videos. And I'll talk about a portal a web link that people can go to if they've got questions or want to participate in future research along these lines. The dirty little secret about your standard test, and maybe in a sense an answer to a question that might pop up in a listener's mind, is the DNA you get from both parents tells you both sides, but it only tells you a few generations. So let me clarify what I'm talking about. If you're listening and you're saying, okay, the Y chromosome, father, son, well, what about mom's side? Your whole book is based on male inheritance. Aren't you leaving out half the story? And the answer is yes, but one of the limitations on these tools are as follows. So if you look at just female inherited DNA, this would be another type of DNA known as the mitochondrial DNA. That's where you have a lot of statistical noise. But 99% of our DNA, this is the DNA we get from both parents. That's why we look like a mix of our parents. Well, the dirty little secret in this type of DNA test is, yes, it's powerful in that it records both sides of your family tree, but the inherent weakness is the other side of the sword, so to speak. It's a two-edged sword. Yes, it's both sides, but that means your genetic signal drops precipitously every generation. So let's think about the math real briefly. I am 50% genetically, on average, each of my parents, 50% DNA from my dad, 50% from my mom. Well, the same principle holds true for my parents. My dad is 50% of his dad, 50% of his mom, same thing for my mother. So that means then effectively, I am 25% genetically each of my parents, 50% my parents, 25% grandparents. And as you do the math further, 12.5% great grandparents, 6.25%, it drops off by half exponentially every generation. Mm-hmm. So you go back just a few generations and the percent that you are, that I am genetically, is so small, you get now into the uncertain range. So I'm calling it a dirty little secret because my guess is many people already know their family tree back to the grandparents, great-grandparents, great-great-grandparents. And if you take your standard genetic test, you're not going to learn much more than that. It'll probably tell you what you already know. Now, it can be a great tool because, you know, we've had people write in saying, well, I'm adopted. How do I figure out my family tree? Or I'm a female and I don't have living male relatives. What do I do? Well, these types of tests can be a great place to start. These databases are pretty big. So you can take your standard genetic test. Sure, it's limited. You can't go back maybe more than four or five generations, but you can find relatives this way, maybe a second cousin, and they might have a family tree worked out and you can kind of begin to build your family tree from the ground up. So there are limits. Yes, it does both sides. There are limits in terms of how far back in time you can go, but it's a great way to start building your family tree from the ground up. And the great strength of the Y chromosome is you can go deep back in history. So yes, it's only one side of the family tree, but the flip side of that is you're not getting mom's DNA diluting the genetic signal. And that's not a criticism. That's just talking about the biological facts. And so I can trace my unbroken line of male descent, frankly, all the way back to Noah. That's one of the big surprises of the book, mm-hmm. is any person, any male who takes a Y chromosome test, they can write in. Well, the book itself has a table at in the last color plate. There's 235 color illustrations. Yeah. The last one is a table, 4-page table, saying, if this is your genetic result, this is the son of Noah you come from. This is some of the details of your family history. This is the chapter you can go to read more about it. And some of these companies don't always report consistently the type of results. So there's a web link as well I've supplied in the book for if you've got questions and such. I can give it now. It's ancestorsandgenesis.org. That's our homepage. So ancestorsandgenesis.org/go/traced. And so there's research that's still ongoing. I'll probably take me the rest of my life to figure out. This is really just the beginning. But if people get results, and I've got a lot of messages this way saying, hey, this is my result from 23andMe or from Family Tree DNA or some other company, what does it mean? Which son of Noah do I come from? We can look it up in 10 seconds and send them an email back. It's a really powerful tool to take you all the way back to the beginning, or the effective restart, I should say, of humanity, history of civilization after the flood with Noah and his family. So there's a tremendous time depth to the Y chromosome. There's not so much that with your standard genetic test, but there's other things it can do.
Yeah, so we'll make sure we include that link on our show summary that we post to our website for the various podcasts. I got your book open right now, and I was going to mention that, you know, you've got these awesome, what you call color plates, and there's 235 of them. And, you know, you go through the book, and you reference these, and they're just so helpful. And probably my favorite was the one you just mentioned, slide 235, because it gives a chart of Ham, Shem, and Japheth, and you can find out if you do a Y chromosome test, and I think we'll try to explain how to do that. We'll point to your website. If you actually do the more reliable test that takes you farther back in time, you can come look at this table and say, oh, okay, looks like maybe I'm related to Japheth, and let's see, I go to chapter 8 and 14, and I can read more about the indigenous European lineage or whatever it is. It's super cool. I really think this book should become a textbook, definitely a reference for people to use in population genetics. I love the way your book is laid out. It was just a joy to read it. This is a great resource. We'll also have a link. I think you guys are going to carry it at ancestorsandgenesis.org/store, and it'll be for release, if I recall, either late June or early July. So I'm kind of one of the lucky ones. I got one, everybody. I got it right here. And I think Amazon mentioned, I think, late June. Actually, Answers in Genesis has a slightly better price for it. But yeah, what a great book this is. I did want to get back to, real quickly, the Y chromosome and how, you know, robust it is overall. I'm sure you've heard of, because we mentioned it on RSR, when they compared it to the chimp Y chromosome, it was 30% different. And the scientist who made the discovery that they reported the article on, he said it was horrendous. Now, when you went to Harvard, did they teach you that horrendous was a scientific term?
I don't recall it being used in any of my classrooms or discussions.
Yeah. So anyways, that's kind of a side point, that the Y chromosome itself is powerful evidence that we're not related to chimps. The other thing I wanted to ask you about is previous research on genetics. I know that reading your book, you've acknowledged a lot of support you received from Dr. Rob Carter. And I know he did the study with the mitochondrial DNA that, you know, has more noise in it. It's not going to be quite as accurate. But he was able to show that we go back to 3 people groups. And I just wanted to kind of get your comment on that based on your book. You know, here at RSR, I'll kind of give you a little aside before you comment. We've got a page, rsr.org/Canaan, and we believe the Bible actually makes a really good case that there were 4 daughters of Eve because Ham had slept with his mom based on the biblical text. So Canaan is really the product of his mom. So his mom is his grandma. So that's another story. It'd be great at some point if you looked at that and could comment for us for the show. But in the meantime, if you could comment on Dr. Rob Carter's work and how he helped you with your work.
Yeah, we've had a long working relationship, work for different organizations, but he and I have done a lot of collaborative work. I started at the Institute for Creation Research in 2009. I got my PhD in 2009 and joined ICR a few months later. He's been at Creation Ministries International for quite some time and had published a couple of years prior on mitochondrial DNA. And I had also done some work on that with him. And both of us pointing to the mitochondrial DNA clock. So in this case, instead of measuring the number of differences between fathers and sons, you're looking between mothers and daughters. Technically, you could do between mothers and sons because mothers pass it on to their sons as well, but then it stops the sons. They don't pass it on. It's only the moms that do. So it's a slightly different biology than the Y chromosome because both genders have it. It's only moms that pass it on, whereas the Y chromosome, only the males have the Y chromosome. There's no female component to it at all or female inheritance. So both of us had seen, if you look at the rate at which the mitochondrial DNA mutates, changes, again, that's also consistent with going back to common ancestors 4,500, 6,000 years ago. And it does look like there's three major nodes, three major ancient groupings that would seem to roughly correspond to the three wives of Noah's sons. And I was working on trying to take that further in 2015 to see if we can look at the next major biblical event. My thought was, and to think of the acronym summary or the alliterative summary, have it answers in Genesis for biblical history, creation, corruption, catastrophe, confusion. So creation of the world, the fall, the flood, and then Babel. I thought was, okay, we've got some good genetic evidence for the time scale. We've got some good genetic evidence for the flood anthropology. It would seem that the next major biblical event would be Babel. So can we find the echo, the genetic echo of Babel in our mitochondrial DNA? Because that was the primary data set I was looking at that time. And at that time, I also started a collaboration with a linguist thinking, well, Babel is primarily a linguistic event. Yes, it would have genetic consequences, but it's not saying in Genesis 11 that God is confusing their DNA. He's confusing their languages and forcing them to separate, which of course that separation will leave an echo in our DNA. So long story short, it became clear, and of course this is well, of course it is true in retrospect, but it took us a while to get there. There's two things that came out of that collaboration with a linguist, and I'll get back to Rob Carter here in a moment. First of all, you can change your language. You can't change your DNA. The best example of this would be African Americans, or an easily understandable example would be African Americans. They're unambiguously at the genetic level African in origin due to the ugly history of the transatlantic slave trade. But of course, today they're speaking not African languages, but ones that have come over from Europe. If you're in Latin America, let's say Spanish or Portuguese, or here in the North, English, or if you're in Canada, French in some places. So that was one element. The other thing, the biggest thing to come out of that, though, was to realize biblically, Babel is not the end of the biblical anthropology, the confusion, and then the end. It's Babel plus 4,000 years of migration, conquest, rape, pillage, slaughter, all that. And you can see it even in the history of Israel. They come out of Egypt with a mixed multitude. Joseph marries an Egyptian lady. So two tribes of Israel, Manasseh and Ephraim, have an Egyptian mother for their heritage. You've got the nation going into the promised land, failing to drive out the people that are there. Explicit statements in Judges saying that the sons of Israel given to the daughters of the people of the land, the sons of the people of the land given to the daughters of Israel, and back and forth. So you have intermixing there. You, of course, have the northern tribes conquered by Assyria and deliberately intermixed with other people. You have the southern tribes, some of who are hauled off to Babylon, some who escaped to Egypt. And this is all hundreds of years before Christ. So if this is how the nation of Israel's history played out, how much more so the rest of the people of the globe where there's no religious reason to stick together or any of those sorts of things? And so, long story short, that forced me to say, you know what? We shouldn't be looking for the echo of Babel. Instead, what we should be doing is starting closer to the present, looking for the echo of recent historical events and working our way backwards until we get back to Babel. And this is where Rob Carter comes back in. At that time, then he was working heavily on the Y chromosome, and we were trying to bring these two data sets together, the Y chromosome and the mitochondrial DNA, to look for echoes of recent history. And to summarize a whole lot of research, what came out of it then was this recent research on the Y chromosome. I published a couple of papers on that. And then this book, of course, Traced, Human DNA's Big Surprise, looks at, and the major focus of the book is looking at the echoes of the history of civilization. And that right there is, to me, one of the strongest arguments. So you quoted the Amazon page, strongest arguments in print for the recent origin of humanity. It's not just that the rate of DNA change supports the young Earth timescale. It's that we can see real history, known historical events read off of our Y chromosome, but we can see it only when we have the young Earth timescale. That is makes a powerful family tree-wide argument for this being evidence for recent origin. And also, and in one of the last chapters of the book, I show that Genesis 10, which is a bunch of males listed in their genealogical relationships, you can see the very clear echo of this at the base of the Y chromosome family tree, DNA-based family tree, which is also another strong independent line of evidence indicating that what we're looking at is exactly in line with what Scripture teaches and a strong contradiction to what the mainstream scientific community holds to.
Yeah, and I love how you built up to that, really, that amazing amount of evidence. So, you know, at Real Science Radio, we often talk about predictions being the hard currency of science. Your research in this book, they have some astounding confirmed predictions that you document in the book. And I'm sure there's going to be so many more that come out from this.
Yes, and what's been remarkable is to see some of the critics respond, and we'll probably have a video on this coming forward in the next couple months or so. And I'm glad you brought that up. I don't know that I was trying to say that, but that history does illustrate we're basically following the evidence where it leads, following the predictions, making predictions and seeing if they come true, testing things. This whole process has been all about, can we do science, essentially? That's what it is. Can we do experiments? We've got this biblical framework. We can derive some expectations from it, and then we can go out to the data and test it, and then make a discovery and say, okay, well, this raises a new hypothesis. Let's go test that one. Interesting, new discovery, another hypothesis. Go test that one. And of course, there's many more that falls out of this, comes out of this research in Traced. Well, what have the critics done? And I kid you not, and this has been a great gift, and this is what we're going to write up. One of the critics who did like an hour review of the book, a PhD, I think he's in virology, but he's got some history trying to criticize creation scientists. One of his first points is, Jensen's wrong because he confuses, and he uses these terms, genealogy and phylogeny. So he'd say genealogy is what you can do to figure out the family history, your own family, or let's say you're talking about animal species, the parent offspring. Yeah, that's all relevant, he says. But then there's this whole other layer of processes, natural selection, evolutionary processes, that you have to incorporate before you can then make a conclusion about phylogeny, the deeper history. So his point was, Jensen is doing this wrong because he's made genealogy equivalent to phylogeny. And see, the textbook says you shouldn't do that. Literally, he's citing textbook evidences. And so this is what's so mind-blowing to me is, and again, some of these unforced errors are just tremendous gifts to the creation science community. We have on one side, the creation scientists saying, let's go do experiments. Let's test these hypotheses, go to the lab or go to the data sets and see if this makes sense. And on the other side, you have evolutionists literally saying, sorry, that can't be true because the book that we trust says otherwise. Yeah. This is a complete reversal of roles. That's, of course, the long-standing gripe about the young earth creationists saying, well, you guys just hold to this holy book and you say if it violates the holy book, then we can't, it must not be true. We're over here trying to do science and you're anti-science. And we have a complete reversal of roles where the creationists are saying, why don't we test these hypotheses and see if what you're saying is textbook science actually works? And they're saying, no, you must be wrong because the textbook says otherwise. You really can't make this up. It's a tremendous advance. I think it speaks to the testimony of the maturity of the creation science movement. I expect it. I've been saying, you'll know that we've arrived when the creationists and the evolutionists trade places and they use arguments against us that we've been using against them and vice versa.
Yeah.
I don't know that I expected them to say it quite that way, but this is explosive, not a testimony to me. It's a testimony to the veracity of Scripture.
Oh, absolutely.
We can reach such a state. And it's just, I'm still laughing at it, the way this is all played out.
Yeah. Well, Dr. Jensen, stop doing science for crying out loud. That's amazing. Wow. With all the things you've found in your book, I mean, you've traced a lot of history, you know, like, for example, I bet the audience might want to hear about America and, you know, the Native Americans and the history before that. You know, if you could expound on that, and then maybe, is there one surprise that you uncovered in all this research that maybe stood out the most to you? Maybe they all stood out, but, you know, maybe one in particular was like super surprising. And then also if you could comment on, you know, Native Americans and their history.
Yes, and I think it's the Native American history that's perhaps was one of the biggest surprises. But before I get to that, save it for the end here. There's a couple things of context I want to say real fast that I think are helpful, anecdote or two. I remember talking to a pastor who is, I think, kind of been on the fence as to age of the earth and such, didn't know what to make of it, didn't know if he wanted to land real hard on it. And at some point a couple of years ago, when he realized, oh, young earth creation scientists aren't just criticizing evolution, which, by the way, I endorse criticizing evolution. There's some big holes in it. We should do that. But this was just him saying, well, that's just kind of criticism. Once he realized, oh, there's scientific advances we're making, there's new discoveries creation scientists are making, they're doing real research, a light bulb went on in his head and he got really excited. Well, this is really cool, he thought. I can't believe this is actually occurring. And I think it was in the context of the Native American discovery. So again, before I get into that specific explosive discovery, just a brief note on how the book is laid out. It's primarily a history book, and I probably get in trouble for saying this. I've been saying it's primarily a history book, not an apologetics book. However, it has these gigantic apologetic ramifications, namely, we're doing science. And it's led to this complete reversal of roles in the creation evolution debate. So the book has as its organizing principle, trying to tell the story, the history of the peoples of the globe, around the globe, sort of a comprehensive rest of the story that I never learned in history class. And that's not a criticism of history. You can't talk about it unless you have the tools. Mm-hmm. Most of us, I think, have grown up learning political history, cultural history, religious history. You learn about the history of Western civilization, when Rome is founded, when it falls. But you never learn the story of who the Roman people came from or what they were doing, if you think from a young earth perspective, from the flood, 2500 BC or so, whatever date you pick, to about 700 BC when they say Rome was founded. Or the 700s BC when Rome was founded. That's almost 2,000 years of mystery. Where were they? What were they doing? Who did they come from? And then, of course, the other side of the equation is when Rome falls, or at least the Western Roman Empire falls in the AD 400s, what happens to the people? Do they become the modern Italians? Do they go extinct? Can modern Italians or Italian Americans legitimately claim these people as their ancestors? Those are all open questions until you have DNA to answer that. And that's what this book tries to do. It walks around the globe, seven major civilizations or cultures, one for each of the major regions, asking the question, who do they come from? What happens to them after their civilization falls? One of the crazy answers, so here's one of the surprises for me, was to see how interconnected the peoples of the globe were. The political organizational structure might fall, and the people themselves might become the people of the next civilization, how one merges into another. That was so crazy to me. And I wanted to add here as well, I may have implied something that needs to be corrected earlier. A Y chromosome test tells you one small part of your family tree. You can knock yourself out doing Y chromosome tests for all sorts of other branches of your family tree. And we've been trying to do this in my own family. So for example, I've done my Y chromosome. This is my paternal line, Jeanson. We'd like to be able to test a relative of my father's mother's side. We've also done on my mother's side, my mother's brother. And we'd like to be able to test one of my mother's mother's male relatives. And what you'll find out likely, if you do this or our listeners do this, is all of us have a very messy, interconnected history, because that's the history of the globe. Messy interconnectedness. We're probably all descended from each of the three boys of Noah. The specific line that I've done for the Jeanson comes from Shem, as do many Western Europeans, due to recent migrations of Central Asians. So there's another surprise. Most light-skinned Caucasian-looking people like me are actually Central Asian in origin, going back just 1,000 years. And my ancestors, probably your ancestors, go back to people who probably looked more Chinese than they looked European. Huh. Anyway, yeah. That's also another good segue into the history of the Americas. This is one of the most explosive aspects of this book. This is chapter 12 of it, looking at who do the Native Americans come from. And the answer is far more surprising than the current narrative. So the current narrative, the mainstream narrative, is that the Native Americans descend from a group of people who migrated across the Bering Strait from Central Asia about 15,000 years ago, and then basically sat here doing very little for 14,500 years until Europeans arrived. It almost completely disconnects the history of the Americas from all the history that we learn in school about Western world, or nowadays, I think there's more and more Eastern history incorporated, history of China, history of India, maybe the Pacific and such. All that is disconnected from the Native American history. Well, what's wild about what the Y chromosome implies about the pre-Columbian Americas? So first of all, it says that today's Native Americans were not the first. So what does that mean? We have evidence for at least two settlings, if not more, perhaps three or four. There's some population replacement events long before Europeans have arrived. Well, I should say some of them long before, some of them very close to it. So one of the most recent settlings of the Americas, one of the most recent migrations to the Americas, was about 1000 AD, when again, some Central Asians, Siberians crossed over, came and spread throughout the Americas. That's very interesting, number one, because now we have some dates that can anchor us in the history that we learned in school, and in fact, can connect it to the history that's related to the settling of Europe. I just mentioned many Europeans trace their ancestry, according to the Y chromosome, back to Central Asia around 1000 AD, which is right around the same time there's another group that heads over to the Americas. So there's a relationship between many Europeans and Native Americans. When the Europeans arrived, it might be more accurate to say it wasn't so much a meeting of long-separated foreigners, but a reunion of relatives, because many Europeans and many Native Americans both trace their ancestry to Central Asia. It's a hotbed of migration and movement, partly due to geography and the pastoral nature of these peoples rather than being agricultural and sedentary. Anyway, back to the Americas. 1000 AD, you've got a crossing. Perhaps the most significant crossing as it relates to modern Native Americans was around the 300s to 600s AD. Another group crossed over. They're the dominant lineage now in today's Native Americans. They appear to have perhaps wiped out some of who were here earlier. One of the major great cities of the pre-Columbian Americas was in Mexico called Teotihuacan. Mainstream archaeology says that in about 600 AD, the city underwent a violent overthrow. There's evidence of burning and such. And that's exactly around the time when this group of Central Asian migrants arrives in the Americas and spreads rapidly throughout the Americas, up and down the Americas, and may have a causal role, may be one of the causes of the downfall of this city of the Teotihuacans. Of course, one of the great mysteries of the Americas is why the Mayan civilization underwent a dramatic collapse in the 800s to 900s. And now we've got a potential new hypothesis to explore that as well. So 1000 AD, there's a crossing. 600s to 300s AD, there's a crossing, which again, this connects us to known historical events. What happens around the 400s AD? Central Asians, the Huns, come into the Roman Empire and overthrow it, along with other Germanic peoples. The mainstream historical community talks about this era with a German word, Völkerwanderung, translated meaning the great wandering of peoples. This is exactly when there's another group that wanders over to the Americas. So it anchors Native American history, pre-Columbian history, firmly in the history we already know. And so future research, I haven't finished the Native American story, and that's because we don't yet have all the evidence. We haven't yet found the lineage of the Mayans, the lineage of the Olmecs, some of the first peoples who were here. This is research that's ongoing. So if any of our listeners are Native American or have connections to, let's say, Guatemala, or want to participate in future research, this is one of these open questions that we're still trying to investigate further. There may not be a Mayan lineage that still exists because of all the population collapses and such that have happened post-arrival of Europeans, pre-arrival of Europeans and such. But this is one of the biggest new developments that falls out of this research. I think it's this type of research that this pastor friend of mine was so excited about. Oh, wow, you're actually advancing our knowledge about the world. It isn't just anti what's going on, but pro, hey, let's advance what we know or have forgotten or lost about the past. I should mention here as well, there are Native American accounts that match almost precisely the history that I've just described. And this has been one of the most satisfying aspects of this research, to be able to, in a sense, give people their history back. And this isn't just the only example. I've got about a list of seven, a growing list of indigenous accounts from various places around the world, Asia, Africa, where the native people say, this is who we come from. The Y chromosome echoes it almost exactly. My guess is the mainstream community would dismiss it as maybe mythological or we just don't know what to make of it. And here we can give them their history back. So this is some of the just sort of a fraction of what's going on with this new research. To me, it's really exciting. If there's students listening, scientists listening who want to participate, there's so much more to be done. I think it's a really exciting field to get into. So I'd encourage anyone who's considering this. It's really, in a sense, an Indiana Jones type experience for archaeology and genetic archaeology, and so much more to discover that I think could get people really excited.
Yeah, that it's so cool how your work is matching a lot of things in history, and it's giving us more details of history. Now, I imagine this book probably won't be on Mormon bookshelves. I don't think that's going to work for them.
I have had some messages from Mormons who are trying to encourage me to read the Book of Mormon and such, and really want to talk more of that. But yes, I think it might create some problems for their view of the origin of the Native Americans. The lineages that we see are, the primary one is Semitic in origin, but not through the Israelites. It's through one of Joktan's sons. We have that level of detail that we can see.
Yep.
And I think that will throw a wrench into what's been stated as the origin of the Native Americans.
Exactly. So we're almost out of time, Dr. Jensen. I'd like to ask one last question. We have a youth conference coming up. Is there any advice that you can offer them? You know, I'm sure some of them are going to be heading off to college. Some are already in college. And if maybe you could share your experience at Harvard, or any words of advice as they head into this world that's going to have so much opposition to their worldview, especially in the, you know, they're already getting indoctrinated in the public schools. Now they're heading off to college. What advice do you have for them?
The first thing that comes to mind is don't go until you're prepared. And that may seem a little bit jarring because today's culture is go, 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 get through faster, strive higher, go longer, get through school as quick as you can, advance as far as you can. And what I mean is, I can look back at my own experience, thanks to my parents, had a very strong creationist upbringing and could tell the evolutionists their view almost as good as they could. That's not bragging as much as if you think about debates, one of the first rules of thumb is you need to know your opponent's position better than they do. And college isn't supposed to be debate. At least I don't think most students think about, yeah, I'm going to go off to college so I can do some debating. It's I'm going to go off to college so I can learn. But you're going into an environment that's hostile to Christianity. And if you're unprepared for the arguments they're going to levy against you, this could be disastrous. And there is great wisdom in perhaps taking a year off. One of the things I've been trying to think through is how do you prepare people better for college? One of the things Answers in Genesis has are these online courses. There's about six of them now. We're going to be adding to them. And I'm hoping to create some of my own related to the books I've done, like Replacing Darwin, also this new book, Traced. How do we prepare students to survive college? And I think one of my colleagues here, Patricia Engler, has also written a book. I think it's called Thrive. Anyway, it's one of the new releases about her experience surviving college and such and going around the globe and taking a tour. Anyway, I recommend that as well. There's other ministries, not necessarily Young Earth. I think it's Summit Ministries. I think they might even be in Colorado there where they've got, you know, take a year off, a gap year between high school and college, get worldview prepared. I don't think they're going to give you Young Earth teaching, but that concept, I think, is extremely valuable to say, hold on, take a check, a sort of a gut check. What is your upbringing? Are you able to articulate what the opponents are going to tell you in the class and then tell you why they're wrong? Or are you going to be completely surprised by it? And there's great wisdom. And I should say this, I think very little harm in taking a year off to say, let me just make sure I've got my spiritual foundations set and I'm prepared for it apologetically. I'm prepared for it in terms of spiritual maturity. So that's the first thing real fast is just to make sure you're prepared. Take a year off if you need to. There's great wisdom in that. It won't hurt you. The culture will say, you know, go fast. You've got to get in as fast as you can. And my experience has been it'll do virtually nothing to your college prospects if you take a year off. And in fact, it may actually help. I remember a friend of mine who was trying to get into medical school. They were looking for unique things people had done. And I think he'd lived in Saudi Arabia a year or whatever it was. And that was actually a bonus for, and an advantage for him because they weren't looking for your generic vanilla flavored person. They had way too many applicants of that sort. They're looking for someone unique. So it may actually help you. The second thing that comes to mind is you have to have a strong church connection. And frankly, I'd say if you don't have a strong church prospect where you're going, and I don't know that I thought this way when I was a student, but I can look back and say I should have thought this way. And in the Lord's providence and grace, I was able to find this. If you don't have a strong church supportive setting where you're considering going, I'd say you probably should reconsider. It is essential to have that sort of support, accountability. When I was off in Boston, there was at a sort of a church plant, but it was catered in a sense to college students where there are transparent guys saying, so what sins are you struggling with? That's essential. You can have the greatest degrees in the world, and if you lose your faith, it's all worthless. If you shipwreck your faith, you fall into sin, you make tragic choices, it can wreck your life. There's a huge element of that that needs to be said. So those are the two main things that come to mind. Is make sure you're prepared spiritually and apologetically before you go, and where you're looking at going, make sure you have a strong support network there. And if there's not, and especially if you're looking at a couple different options, go to the one that does have it, because it has lifelong and perhaps even eternal consequences depending on where you end up.
Well, that is awesome advice for our youth. We're going to have a couple of the youth on the next week's show, and I'm going to be sure to mention the advice that you gave. I think this is really, really fantastic. I haven't quite heard it put that way, but it makes a ton of sense. I want to thank you again for giving us the honor of doing this interview. Wow, this stuff is amazing. And really, for all the work you're doing to promote the overwhelming truth of creation and the God of the Bible. Again, Dr. Jameson, I really appreciate you coming on Real Science Radio.
Fred, it's been a pleasure, and thank you for the opportunity.
So once again, the title of Dr. Jameson's book is Traced, Human DNA's Big Surprise. I guarantee you this is going to be a book that's going to be on the shelf and taken off regularly. Oh, I got to look this up. Oh, I want to go look into this history. You can pre-order this book through Amazon, or better yet, the Answers in Genesis website. It's at answersingenesis.org/store. It looks like it's a slightly better price there, and there's other places you could probably get it. At some point, Nathaniel, I'd like to carry this book at rsr.org in our store. And again, it'll become available in mid-June to early July timeframe. So for Dr. Nathaniel Jameson, this is Fred Williams of Real Science Radio. May God bless you.
Intelligent design and DNA. Scholars can't explain it all away. Get ready to be all.
about.